Continuation, reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4, chapter's entitled Sri Madhavendra Puri's Devotional Service. Continuation, and if you recall from yesterday's reading, we were discussing the glories of this famous verse spoken by Sri Madhavendra Puri, which was also originally spoken by Srimati Radharani in her ecstatic mood of ecstasy from separation, from Lord Sri Krishna when he left Vrindavan. Aidina Dayadra Nata Hai Madhura Nata Kadava Lokasai Hridayam tvar aloka kataram dayite namyate kim karomi aham. Translation from that verse is, O my Lord, O most merciful Master, O Master of Mathura, when shall I see you again? Because of my not seeing you, my agitated heart has become unsteady. O most beloved one, what should I do now? Eya sloka padite prabhum hoi murchite premite vishvashahane pradile bhumite. Translation. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu recited this verse, he immediately fell to the ground unconscious. He was overwhelmed and had no control over himself. So why did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu fall to the ground unconscious when he recited this verse? Anybody know? Yes, but why? Yes, but why? Why did Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu immediately fall to the ground unconscious upon reciting this verse? Simple answer. Because he's Radharani. Radharani was the original one who recited the verse. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has come as Radharani. So again, she was experiencing that same ecstasy when she originally spoke that verse. Excuse me, right? Okay. Asti vyaste kolikare nila nityananda kranda kari etabe uta gura chandra. When Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu fell to the ground in ecstatic love, Lord Nityananda took him on his lap, crying. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then got up again. Exhibiting ecstatic emotions, the Lord began to run here and there, making resounding noises. Sometimes he laughed, sometimes he cried, and sometimes he danced and sang. So sometimes if you saw somebody running around and laughing and then crying and then reciting all kinds of incoherent things, what would you think immediately? What would you do? Call 911? Right? But the madness of this material world is a mental derangement due to over-association with the lower modes of material energy. But there's a kind of madness that comes due to constant association with the spiritual energy. And it exhibits itself similar to symptoms of material madness. But it's the difference between iron and gold. Both are metals, but one is very base and very ordinary, everywhere it's found. The other one is very rare and very valuable. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was experiencing that madness. But if some ordinary person would have seen it, they would probably think, well, what is this? There's a nice story in it's in Chaitanya Bhagavat, wherein Vrindavan Das Thakur narrates one pastime where It's in the life of Srila Haridas Thakur. And Srila Haridas Thakur, of course, we all know that he was on one of the highest stages of love of God. He was constantly absorbed in chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So one day, there was one snake charmer who was a very powerful personality, who inside of the snake charmer's mind and heart existed the personification of Anantadev, who was the supreme snake of all snakes. It's none other than an expansion of Shankarshan or Balaram, the multi-headed snake that is holding up all the universes. And what is the glory, what does Ananta do? Constantly singing the glories of the Lord. So this snake charmer, he started to sing. And while he was singing, of course, that aspect of the Lord within his own heart was actually speaking or singing. And so what had happened was, when Haridas Thakur happened to be coming by, he started to hear that. And he started to dance in ecstasy. And then he started to roll on the ground and exhibit all kinds of uncontrollable ecstatic symptoms. And gradually a large crowd gathered around to see what was happening. So the snake charmer was very happy to see Haridas Thakur's ecstasy. And he started to play his flute even louder. And he started to sing and play his flute. And for Haridas, he was becoming very, very emotionally absorbed in the holy name and the glories of the Lord. So there was one Brahmin there, and he was thinking, you know, well, I can do that too. I can also exhibit these symptoms, and people will also think I'm a great devotee. What's so difficult? So immediately he started to dance, and then he started to roll on the ground, and started to exhibit emotional ecstatic symptoms artificially or falsely. And what happened was the snake charmer, he realized that this man is a phony. He's a pretender. So he got a stick and he started beating him, beating him, beating him. He was yelling, "Mother, Father, save me!" He was crying out for his mother and father. Finally he got up and he ran away in great pain. So later on, people were said to the snake charmer, "Why'd you do that? Haridas, he was dancing like that. Why'd you beat this other man?" And he said, "That actually, Haridas, he is a great devotee of the Lord. And when I was playing my flute, he was exhibiting his natural love of God. But this other man, he was simply a cheater. He was just trying to get some false, cheap popularity, some distinction." And so he could have said, sometimes you see that, you go to Indian temples in India, and there are a class of people who do that. When they hear, or when they come to the kirtan, immediately they'll roll on the ground, or start to dance wildly, or do some all kinds of gestures. And one time one person wanted to impress Prabhupada, so he came to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was sitting in some open darshan with some devotees. So he came in and he just started to sing, and then he sat for a few minutes, and then he fell on the ground and he started to cry. And then he laid there unconscious. So the devotees were thinking, wow, ecstasy. So Prabhupada called the devotees over and said, "Kick him. Go over and kick him." So they did. He started kicking, and for a few minutes he got up and started running away. Prabhupada could see he was a cheater. And a class of people who, for some false name and fame, they try to imitate the advanced symptoms of devotees. And that's why Srila Prabhupada, many times, he would restrain ecstatic emotions. Sometimes he would begin to sing Jai Radha Madhava, and he would go into an ecstasy. And he would start to become stunned and start to feel tears would come to his eyes, and then he would really, from within his utmost efforts, he would try to restrain himself and come back to normal consciousness. Sometimes it was too much, but most of the times he would be able to restrain himself. Because he did that in order to not to give credence to a class of people who like to publicly exhibit themselves with spiritual emotions in a false way. It's very popular. Of course, in America, we don't see that. But if you go to India, there are many places like that. You know, they call them sahajis. Right? Rajgovinda, you've seen such personalities?
Yeah.
In fact, they have their own groups, too. Well, here we're speaking about the genuine symptoms of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his ecstasy, hearing that verse, which was originally spoken by Srimati Radharani. Aidina, aidina, bala, 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 katena nisare, nisare, vani, neta, asrudara. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu could not recite the whole verse. He simply said, aidina, aidina, repeatedly. Thus he could not speak, and profuse tears were in his eyes. Kampasveda pulakasru stamba vai varnarya nirveda visada jadya garva harsa danya nanya. Trembling, perspiration, jubilant tears, shock, fading of the bodily luster, disappointment, moroseness, loss of memory, pride, jubilant, joy and humility were all visible in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's body. If you read to Nectar of Devotion, you'll find that these symptoms are all symptoms of ecstatic love for God. Although they exhibit themselves in the material world in an ordinary way, when connected with one's ecstatic love for God, they also appear, but they're all symptoms of ecstatic love. And there are, I think, something like 32 symptoms of ecstatic emotions, including death. Death is also. Radharani, she almost exhibited that when Krishna left for Vrindavan. She was on the verge of death due to her ecstatic love for Krishna. And because of that, she said one thing. She finally saw Krishna again. Because the gopis were always thinking that Krishna will be coming back. And Krishna left Vrindavan, and in order to go to Mathura, in order to take care of Kamsa and some demons there. And then what happened was, right after that, the turbulence started to break out with the battle of Kurukshetra and all the intrigue in Dwarka, in Hastinapur. So Krishna got involved with all that, and then he set up his headquarters in Dwarka in order to take care of some more demons. So Krishna was gone for 100 years. He was gone from Vrindavan for 100 years. He left when he was just a young boy of about 16 or so. And so he said, when he left, he said, I'm coming back. So the gopis, all the residents of Vrindavan, every day, at the end of the day, they would go out to the edge of the area of Vrindavan and just wait for Krishna to come. And they would sit there and just wait and look, hoping that he would come. But he would never come. So that statement that Krishna made, I'm coming back, kept the hopes of the residents of Vrindavan alive. But inside, they were totally miserable. So Radharani said one thing. She wrote one beautiful thing. She said, Krishna, you're like a man who keeps some domestic animals in his house. But then the house gets set on fire. And the animals, because the door is locked, you have locked the door, the animals cannot get out. And so they're trapped by the blazing fire, and they cannot get out. And she said, so she explained that this fire of separation burning in my heart is compared to that fire. And the locking of the door is the statement that Krishna said, I'm coming back. She said, this is the only thing that's sustaining my life, the fact that you said you were coming back. Imagine how much Radharani suffered in pains of ecstatic symptoms of loving ecstasy for 100 years. Finally, Krishna went back to Vrindavan. They tricked Krishna. The residents of Dwarka, along with Devaki, Balaram, Subhadra, Nardamuni, they all came and they somehow or other tricked Krishna and finally come back after all that time. Krishna was always thinking of Vrindavan. He was always thinking of Vrindavan. In fact, when he was sleeping at night in Dwarka, he would chant the names of the gopis, he would chant the names of the cows, he would chant the names of his mother and father, he would call out in the middle of his sleep at night, he would call out. And the queens would talk amongst themselves, they say, He's always chanting the names of the residents of Vrindavan. He has no interest in us, because Krishna had 16,108 queens in Dwarka. But he was living there, and he was not going in Vrindavan, but he was always thinking of Vrindavan. Krishna was always thinking of going back to Vrindavan. But he had a mission. His mission was he had to relieve the world of all the demoniac forces. So every time there would be so many demoniac forces, and they would build up and they would attack Hastinapur and Yudhisthira. So they would fight, and Krishna would eliminate and kill the armies of Jana and Jarasandra and Shalva and Shishupal and so many. So he was killing one demon after another and after another. So he wanted to finish his mission. So that was the only reason he stayed away, because there was still a few demons left to kill. So this went on for years and years and years and years. And then... but he was always thinking of Vrindavan. So they devised a plot to bring Krishna back to Vrindavan. Narada Muni, Balaram, Subhadra. Finally, they tricked Krishna coming back to Vrindavan. But Balaram told them that if you arrange for Krishna to go back to Vrindavan, he's not going to come back here anymore. Once he goes back to Vrindavan, he'll never come back again. So you better be careful. Once he sees the situation, because he sent Uddhava to pacify the residents of Vrindavan after so many years. And Uddhava looked just like Krishna. He had the same bodily features as Krishna. And when he came, all the residents thought he was Krishna at first. But then they realized it was someone else. And then Uddhava just spoke about the glories of Krishna and what he was doing. And everyone was just sitting around listening. But after a while, they became unhappy, because it just increased their agony of separation from Krishna more and more. So then Uddhava went back, and Uddhava's love for Krishna and Uddhava's intimacy with Krishna was so high that he was a personal, intimate association. He was even more intimate than Arjuna was. Uddhava was very close to Krishna. He was his very, very dear friend. In fact, Krishna talked confidentially with Uddhava about many subject matters that he never revealed to anybody else. He was so close. But when Uddhava went to Vrindavan and he saw the love of the residents of Vrindavan, he realized that his love for Krishna was insignificant. Totally insignificant. When he saw just how much they were suffering, the pains of separation from Krishna, and how much they were willing to go on hoping, praying someday that Krishna would return. Of course, Krishna finally returned after some time, and when he saw the state of affairs, he went into an ecstatic trance of love. And that ecstatic trance of love was exhibited by his arms and his legs recoiling into his body in loving ecstasy. And that is the actual form of Jagannath. Lord Jagannath symbolizes or is the manifestation of Krishna's love for Radharani. That's why when Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was Radharani would see Lord Jagannath, you know, the exchange between Jagannath and Radha and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was non-different than the exchange between Radharani and Krishna and Vrindavan. And that was all exhibited at the Rath Yatra festival. So these are the sweet, wonderful pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan. So here, Chaitanya Charitamrita is exhibiting these emotional symptoms of the Lord towards himself. It's magic. Krishna, Radharani and Krishna comes together in one as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And who is Lord Jagannath? He is Krishna. So Radha and Krishna in one is exhibiting ecstatic love for himself. Interesting. The Lord is exhibiting his own loving ecstasy for his own self. It's hard to understand these things. These are the really deep principles of spiritual life. But ultimately, if you analyze the nature of the Absolute Truth, is there anything else besides Krishna? Everything's Krishna, ultimately. We are parts and parcels of Krishna, so ultimately we are also Krishna too. in the absolute sense. Of course, the philosophy is one and different for exchange of loving ecstasy. But ultimately, our existence is, our essence is that we are non-different in one aspect. So the whole absolute truth is, and as Krishna told Brahma, he said, before the manifestation, all that existed is I. During the creation, all that exists is I. And after the annihilation, all that remains is I. There's nothing else. When we see something else beside Krishna, we see separate. Of course, the understanding is that not everything is Krishna, just like you can't worship the floor. But ultimately, the energy and the energetic is non-different. And the example is the sun and the sun ray. You cannot separate the sun rays from the sun. There's no question of existence for the sun rays. And they're intimately connected with the sun. They have the same qualities of the sun. But the sun rays are not the sun. It's like if the sun comes into your room, sun rays come into your room, you can't say the sun's in my room. What would happen? You have no room left. So in that same way, everything is one and different. So everything ultimately is Krishna, and is at the same time the energy of Krishna. So that's the nature, that's the real understanding of the absolute truth. And that helps us to surrender, because when we surrender to that principle, then we ultimately come back to our real essence. Our essence is to love and serve Krishna. Everything else that we do outside of that is just a manifestation of the separateness of the living entity with the Lord. But that separation is an illusion also. Just like, what's the example of the illusion of separation? It's just like when you go to sleep at night, you dream and you forget your existence. And you're experiencing another existence. You may be chased by a tiger or having some romance or whatever. But ultimately, it's all an illusion, because you're there, you are lying on your bed, and that's your real existence. This is an example. So in the same way, any separateness that we experience is simply an illusion. It's all an illusion. The reality is that our relationship is with Krishna. That's the ultimate nature of the absolute truth. That's why in Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, jeev jago, gora chandra bole, kotanidra jayomaya, pisa chita kole. All the living entities in the material world, they're sleeping. They're sleeping on the material energy. And he compares that to a witch. He calls it a witch of the material energy. And a witch is sucking out the blood of the living entity. And the living entity sleeping soundly, losing their existence due to the association of this witch-like maya, which comes in the form of sense gratification. So he says, wake up. When you wake up, you realize, when the living entity realizes, hey, I'm in an unnatural situation. It's like when we wake up from the dream is over. Then all of a sudden we realize all the suffering and the enjoyment that we were experiencing in the dream was simply a dream. So it's explained that when the living entity comes back to it and reaches the stage of liberation, then they realize that all the experiences they had were simply activities within the dream. This whole material world is a dream. Prabhupada uses a further example, just like at night you dream. So that's a night dream. But in the daytime, because this is also an illusion from the absolute point of view, it's called the illusionary energy, this is also a dream. So in this dream we're suffering and enjoying according to our association with the modes of material energy, and we're identifying with the dream. So Prabhupada clearly explains the only difference between the two dreams is one is longer than the other, that's all. The daydream is a longer dream. We're thinking, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm an Indian, I'm old, I'm young, I'm sick, I'm tired, I'm hungry. And, you know, whatever we identify with our material situation, then that's part of the dream. It's part of the dream. The reality is that we're part and parcel of Krishna. We have an eternal loving relationship with Krishna. So we associate with the material energy in the dream, but we don't identify with the dream as the reality. And that's called detachment. When we become detached from the experiences within the dream, then we don't experience the suffering and the enjoyment that comes with being in the dream state. Although we're in the unnatural situation still, we don't identify that with that as the reality. But the materialists, they identify that as the reality. And therefore, whatever they experience just perpetuates that illusion deeper and deeper. Whereas whatever a devotee experiences in that is an opportunity for bringing one closer to Krishna. Everything that happens to a living entity, if they are on the path of devotional service, is an opportunity for increasing one's relationship with Krishna. Whatever happens. Someone asked you a Prabhupada one time, does every cloud have a silver lining? Just like we experience something that is considered by material definitions to be bad or negative or disappointing. That's considered a cloud. Does all clouds have a silver lining? The question was. Prabhupada said no. He said for the materialist, a cloud is a cloud. Because they live within the illusion and they experience the pains of the illusion. But they identify the illusion as the reality, and so they just perpetuate the illusion by acting in the same way within the category of the three modes. So they may change their forms of illusion, but the illusion remains. And so whatever they experience just entrenches them more in the illusion. But for a devotee, Prabhupada said for a devotee, that, yes, those clouds have a silver lining. Because the experiences, the difficulties, are simply lessons, or messages, or means of purification sent by Krishna in different forms, in order to help us become closer to Krishna, whatever they may be. For a devotee, everything is auspicious, as long as we are on the path of Krishna consciousness. If we deviate from the path, then the results we get, even if we deviate, the inauspiciousness we get from deviating is a means for pushing us back to the auspicious path. If we can see like that, then there's no anxiety. And ultimately Krishna is doing something in order to help us come back to the standard. And ultimately on the path, there's always obstacles and purifications. But these are all sent by the Lord to bring us closer, ultimately. And we see in the scriptures, even the great souls experience so many difficulties and reverses in their attempts to serve the Lord. But these are all opportunities for increasing their devotion and their surrender, like that. So we'll know if, as long as we maintain a principle of following the process as best as we can, we'll always, whatever happens to us is meant for pushing us closer to Krishna. And that's ultimately what we're striving for, to become closer to Krishna. But we have to understand how to understand. When something happens, if we don't understand how to understand, then we have to go to Guru. We have to go to enlightened devotees to get a clarification of why something has happened the way it's happening, and how I can take this opportunity for an advancement in my spiritual life like that. Therefore we have the association of devotees, we have Guru, we have scripture, and that helps us to understand. So these are some points that I thought it might be relevant. Okay, so we'll stop Chaitanya Charitamrita here. Any questions, comments? Okay, Srimad Bhagavatam. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Canto 8, Chapter 8, Text Number 20, The Journey of the Milk Ocean. Nunam tapo yasya na manyu nirjayo jnanam kvachit tach cha na sangha varjitam kasin mahams tasya na kama nirjaya sa ishvara kim parato vyapasrayaha nunam tapo yasya na manyu nirjayo jnanam kvachit tat cha na sangha varjitam kasin mahastasya na kama nirjaya sa ishvara kim parato vyapasrayaha nunam tapo yasya na manyu nirjayo jnanam kvachit tat cha na sangha varjitam kasin mahastasya na kama nirjaya sa ishvara kim parato vyapasrayaha nunam tapo yasya na manyu nirjayo jnanam kvachit tat cha na sangha varjitam kasin mahastasya na kama nirjaya sa ishvara kim parato vyapasrayaha in some saintly person. Tat, that. Cha, also. Na, not. Sangavarjitam, without the contamination of association. Kaschit, someone. Maham, a very great exalted person. Tasya, his. Na, not. Kama, material desires. Nirjaya, conquered. Sa, such a person. Ishvara, controller. Kim, how can he be? Parata, of others. Vyapasrayaha, under the control. translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The Goddess of Fortune, examining the assembly, thought in this way, someone who has undergone great austerity has not yet conquered anger. Someone possesses knowledge, but he has not conquered material desires. Someone has a very great personality, but he cannot conquer lusty desires. Even a great personality depends on something else. How then can he be the supreme controller? Purport. Here is an attempt to find the supreme controller, or Ishvara. Everyone may be accepted as a controller, but still such controllers are controlled by others. For example, one may have undergone severe austerities, but still be under the control of anger. By scrutinizing analysis, we find that everyone is controlled by something else. No one, therefore, can be the true controller but the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. This is supported by the Shastras, Ishvara Parama Krishna. The Supreme Controller is Krishna. Krishna is never controlled by anyone, for He is the controller of everyone, Sarva Karna Karnam. Translation once again, the Goddess of Fortune, examining the assembly, thought in this way, someone who has undergone great austerities has not yet conquered anger. Someone possesses knowledge, but he has not conquered material desires. Someone has a very great personality, but he cannot conquer lusty desires. Even a great personality depends on something else. How then can he be the supreme controller? Om Ajnanamidandasya Gyananjana Savakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutamai Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swam Padati Kam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaur Bhaktavindam Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So, in this section, Goddess of Fortune Lakshmi Devi is engaged in her swayamvara. She's choosing her husband. And she sees amongst all the participants there the residents from higher planets, Gandharvas, the Yakshas, the Asuras, the Siddhas, the Charanas, denizens of heaven. And she sees that none of these personalities are without fault. Some have performed great austerities, but yet they cannot control anger. The tendency sometimes is persons restrain themselves from sense gratification. But because the desires within the heart still remain, they exhibit or feel the pressure of anger. And in restricting their senses and the objects of the senses, they feel some agitation. And so that manifests itself sometimes in anger. So, of course, one should perform austerities, but one should perform austerities that are conducive to one's devotional service. Of course, there may be some tension. It's just like when you're tuning a guitar, those of you who have some familiar with guitar strings, if you make the string too tight, when you play it, what happens? Breaks. If you make it too loose, what happens? What doesn't happen? There's no sound. The sound is not right. So, in performing austerities, if we perform austerities beyond our needs, then we become sometimes a little tense, overcome by anger. Or if we perform least austerities, we get too lax, and then we really don't have any enthusiasm in our spiritual life. So there has to be some balance there. When the chord is strung properly, then the music comes out quite melodiously and naturally. Sometimes those who perform austerities exhibit the feelings of anger. So the Goddess of Fortune, she was seeing this as a defect. It's nice. Austerities are nice. When Brahma was asked to meditate, He heard the sound that gave them the signal, tapa. Brahma heard the Lord speaking, tapa. Tapa means penance or austerity. So austerities are a part of Krishna consciousness. What are the austerities? There are three categories of austerities. Austerities of the mind, austerities of the body, and austerities of speech. Each category has four topics. Who knows the austerities of the mind? Does anyone know? What is one of the austerities of the mind?
Detachment from thoughts of sense gratification.
Yes, detachment from sense gratification, objects of sense gratification. What is another one?
Always thinking of Krishna.
Well, that's there. That's not mentioned, though. These are just basic preliminary austerities. In other words, certain qualities that are necessary to exhibit in performing the austerities. Serenity is one of the austerities of the mind. Yes? Yeah, but they're exhibited serenity, detachment from sense objects, and gravity. Gravity. A devotee is meant to be grave. Grave means, Prabhupada says, when a person is grave, you cannot tell what they are thinking. One time, one devotee in New Vrindavan, he saw a picture of Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was like this, you know, like staunch with his danda in here. So he said to Prabhupada, "Prabhupada, you look so sad there." Prabhupada said, "What do you mean sad? I'm feeling ecstatic symptoms in that picture." Prabhupada remembered, I mean, he was feeling so happy in that picture. But externally, he was exhibiting, you know, this very grave. Prabhupada explains through scripture that gravity means you cannot tell the mind of a person. So that's one of the... That means they're in deep thought about how to execute Krishna consciousness or how to... how they're thinking about Krishna. Sometimes people mistakenly think, "Oh, you look all unhappy. Why are you so unhappy? You should be singing and dancing and being so friendly and jubilant and bubbly." You know, sometimes people think that that's Krishna consciousness. That is also. But many times it exhibits itself in gravity, deep thought, grave. It's called Gambhira. And that's austerities of the mind. And then there's austerities of the body. Who knows what are the austerities of the body? There are four.
No.
Austerities of the... Cleanliness is one. These are all mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter. Cleanliness is one of the austerities of the body. To keep clean cloth, change your clothes each day, and to take bath. It's mentioned in the 7th canto that one should bathe twice a day. And that for a civilized human society, 2 baths a day are required. Of course, sometimes in the dead of winter, it's a little hard to take 2 baths. But one should bathe after evacuating, and one should bathe every morning upon rising. These are minimal requirements for bathing. Growing up in Western society means uncleanliness, pretty much. I remember when I was growing up, you know, it was like Saturday night bath. That was it. Again, once a week you get a bath on Saturday night. I'm revealing all my glorious past. So, you look, I can remember the water when it was going down the drain. It was like this big gray film on the top, you know, thick. It was like, you know, you could scoop it up and roll it into a ball. Once a week, you know, and people still, many people don't bathe every day. But this is a simple minimum required to bathe every day, especially upon rising. And clothes should be changed every day. and keeping clean cloth. So this is called an austerity of the body. It's very essential. Brushing the teeth, keeping nice appearance. Prabhupada says, we eat to please ourselves, and we dress to please others. So when you dress, you're doing that for the benefit of others. Not like a materialist, they want to show off their body, and so they dress in so many ways to attract people. But we dress in order to please others, in other words, nicely, simply, cleanly, clean. So when people see, it reminds them of devotion, it reminds them of Krishna, like that. So that's important. So that's one of the austerities of this cleanliness. What's another one? Does anyone know? Huh? Celibacy. It's called celibacy. Another austerity of the body is celibacy. And then Krishna says, Bharatas, Kamos Smi Bharatasabha. And then sex life is only allowed within the Grihastha ashram and only for propagation of children. Otherwise, sex indulgence is restricted. And that is the gross form. Subtle levels of sex desires, now one should not think of it. One should not make plans to engage in it. One should not. There's 8 symptoms of brahmacharya that one must follow in order to maintain the status of brahmacharya. Planning about it, thinking about it, arranging for it, meeting, like that. These are all breaking the principles of celibacy. So one should free the mind from licentious and sensual thoughts by always thinking of Krishna and by always engaging in devotional service. Replace one thought with another. The simple process is that these thoughts come, especially due to the association of Kali Yuga, which is permeated. The entire ether is permeated with these thoughts. And so even many great personalities will be attacked by these thoughts, either subtly or grossly, because that is the nature of Kali Yuga. It's so bad. It's in the ether. So one counteracts these things by immediately thinking of Krishna, chanting Krishna's name, and keeping the mind fixed in devotional service. And this maintains a sense of celibacy in our consciousness. As we allow these thoughts to exist within the mind, they dilute our determination in spiritual life, and again reawaken our desires for material enjoyment. So they're very, very dangerous and should be restricted, eliminated. As one devotee, when I joined the movement in New York City back in the 70s, one devotee was telling me, I was explaining, I was having some of these thoughts. He says, immediately you have to kill it. He said, if you don't kill it, it'll kill you. Don't be whimsical or humble when it comes to these thoughts. Immediately one should very forcefully push them out and replace them with Krishna consciousness. One should not analyze them. One should not try to understand them. One should just push them out. Because if you try to analyze them or understand them or dwell on them, they grow. By associating with them in any form, they grow. Immediately they have to be pushed out. And then, as you push them out, less they come back, less and less, like that. So celibacy is another austerity of the mind. What is another one? There's 4. Cleanliness, celibacy, nonviolence. Nonviolence is another austerity of the body. Not causing violence to any other living entity. And that is takes its form both in subtle and gross activities. There are 3 kinds of violence. Violence caused by one's words. Violence caused by one's actions, by one's words, or even by one's thoughts, I believe. Of course, those... actions, words, and physical violence. In other words, these actions are divided into 2 categories, like that. So that means not causing any anxiety to any living entity, on any level. If one says something harsh, unduly to a person, that's a form of violence. If one puts another person in an awkward situation due to their own improper actions, that's a form of violence. So scripture gives real subtle definitions of what violence really is. It's not just some gross act of, you know, physical violence, but it's also, therefore, we always be very careful what we say and how we say it. Because speech actually is a stronger form, can be a stronger form of violence than physical violence. Just like if someone you love says something that really hurt you, sometimes it goes so deep that one can never forget that. Have you had some experience that something happened to you many years ago by someone who was very close to you, and it really pierced your emotions and your heart? You still remember that? Yeah. But sometimes we forget about the physical violences. But words can be very, very strong in causing anxiety to a living entity, especially when they are done within the family. People commit more suicide in family-related exchanges than any other. One time I was traveling here in Chicago, and we got a flat tire. It was on a Sunday morning. And so we were stuck, and so the police came by. So I was talking to the police officer. I said, well, it's Sunday morning, you guys probably don't have much to do. He said, are you kidding? This is our most active time, the weekends. The weekends and Sunday, because this is when domestic violence is the worst. Family members, they fight. He said, this is the worst kind of violence, too. And I just say something, and pretty soon it gets so out of hand, and then people are raised to you. And somebody who you have some affection for, or you have some intimacy with, does something, whew, that pain stays for a long time. So I'm bringing out this point that in an association of devotees, it's like a family. So we have to be also very, very careful how we treat each other and how we speak and how we interact. And always giving respect and honor to others and not expecting any in return. And be very cautious on speech, because it doesn't take much to say something out of passion and not even meaning it, and pretty soon there's some offense and there's some problems there. So we have to be very careful. So violence comes on subtle levels, gross levels like that. To avoid that is an austerity of the body. It's one of the four austerities. Nonviolence, celibacy, cleanliness, and there's one more. I can't remember the last one. Austerities of the body. Huh? Truthfulness? Isn't that austerities of speech? Yeah. And that's the last category. It's austerities of the mind, austerities of body, and austerities of speech. Speech, austerity means to speak truthfully, beneficially, avoid speech that offends, and to recite the Vedas regularly. In other words, one should back up what they say with scripture. Like that, in order to give authority to one's word. So these are mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, the austerities of speech, truthfully and beneficially. And of course, Rupa Goswami explains in his Nectar of Devotion, Nectar of Instruction, that prajalpa, unnecessary talk, or talks that are not related to one's devotional life, is a fall down in Krishna consciousness. There are different categories of useless speech, and they comprise eight categories. He explains the categories is called a broad category where the speech is not related to Krishna. But Bhashila Bhakti Vinod Thakur explains in his Bhakti Loka, his critique of Rupa Goswami's work, that they comprise eight categories. He calls them worldly talks, useless talks, gossip, lies, fault finding, what's some of the other ones? Debate, and one more. Can't remember what's the last one. So he divides it into eight categories, and in these eight categories he gives an explanation of each of the categories. that there's so many ways to deviate. And he explains that in this age, most talk is godless. When you speak to people most of the time, it's all godless or useless talk, practically. No one speaks really anything relevant. Of course, if you live in the world and you have a job, and then you're allowed to speak on the basis of carrying out your occupation and family needs. So he calls these worldly talks, but worldly talks are only allowed for grihasthas, or those who associate with the material energy in order to perform some kind of occupation or job. But then he gives restrictions on these things also, too, and only according to what is essential for carrying on one's occupation. But if we go beyond that, and then we get into the realm of showing attachment or affection for the material energy by engaging in topics which are irrelevant to our existence. And that's one way to fall down. So this proper control of speech by eliminating the negative helps us to automatically follow the positive. By eliminating the negative, that's all that's left is the positive. What is the positive? Speaking about Krishna, speaking about Krishna consciousness activities, and things in related to one's devotional service like that. And that can be pretty broad too, but Krishna consciousness is not narrow. There's so many things we can speak about. So these are some of the austerities. Austerities of the mind, austerities of the body, and austerities of speech. So one should be careful in performing austerities and not simply perform austerities for the sake of austerities. There was one devotee many years ago in the beginning of the movement. He decided, well, I'm going to chant 32 rounds a day. This was the very beginning when Prabhupada was first beginning his movement. And so he wasn't doing much service, but he was spending most of his time chanting his rounds, 32 rounds. So, of course, it aroused the attention of the other devotees, and they brought it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada wasn't pleased, but he didn't do anything. Gradually, he decided to increase his chanting to 64 rounds. Because, you know, Prabhupada, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati says that if anyone who doesn't chant 100,000 names of God every day hasn't reached the human form of life. That's Bhakti Siddhanta, and 100,000 names of God is 64 rounds. So he was thinking, yeah, I'll chant 64 rounds every day. So he was chanting 64 rounds, and he wasn't doing any service. So he brought the attention to Prabhupada. This was in Mayapur. So after a while, Prabhupada didn't say anything. So after a while, he decided that he can't associate with devotees anymore because, you know, they're just not into it. So he built himself a house in a tree. We call it a tree house. And he was living in the tree house and chanting all day. So Prabhupada, when he heard that, he just laughed. He said, soon he will leave. He will go away. You know, tried to help him, preach to him, but devotees couldn't reach him. He was stubborn. After a while, he left. And so this is an example of unnecessary austerity. And one wants to automatically raise themselves to an advanced stage. Sometimes a person will come out of the material world and try to renounce everything they have and automatically dive into Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada gives the example of one man. He was very, very rich. And so he found a guru. And so he was thinking, I have to give everything. He was a very influential man. He was making lakhs and lakhs of rupees every month. So he gave it all up. He became renounced, and just like an ordinary little brahmachari living in an ashram. Prabhupada said after 6 months he died. This extreme from going from one extreme to the other was just too much. Couldn't do it. It wasn't his guru's instructions. He was thinking that that's what I should do, that I have to give it all up. But Krishna doesn't say give it all up. He says engage in my devotional service. He's rasa. What is that verse? Visaya vinivartante niharashi dehiyam raso varjam raso pyasya param drisham nivartante. Param drisham. When you get the higher taste, then you can give up the lower taste. When you taste the sweetness of Krishna consciousness and devotional service, then the paltry things that we found so important in our material life, they seem so insignificant. We're not only, they are insignificant, but we're eager to give them up. But if that's all you know, you can't give them up. So Krishna says, you know, just engage in devotional service, chant my holy name, and read my books like that. And in this way, gradually you'll gain the taste. When you gain the taste, then it's easy to let go of those things that are so important in our spiritual life. So no one can simply perform devotional service by just giving everything up. We have to gradually engage in Krishna consciousness, and gradually these things fall away. Okay, it's getting a little on time. Maybe I'll stop here. Questions or comments on anything? Yes?
Maharishi described how someone may perform austerities, but if that comes with anger, or austerities without artificial evidence of anger. So sometimes with our devotional conduct, we may sense that individually we need to perform more austerities, whether it's minimizing our eating or sleeping or something that we may find that is conducive to our attention. How does one distinguish if this is artificially wanted?
Getting advice from others? That's one way. That's probably the best way. Usually we just do things because that's our tendency. Try to understand one principle very clearly. When you understand this principle, you'll understand everything about Krishna consciousness. That this is a family. Prabhupada wanted to create a family. Devotional service means an environment where devotees work very close together to execute Krishna consciousness. That means we help each other, we assist each other, we enthuse each other. Without that, it's very difficult to be Krishna conscious. So, therefore, we have relationships based on our devotional service. In those relationships, we get advice, we get encouragement, and we speak about, you know, what we're doing, how we're doing it. We should reveal our mind to other devotees, to develop a sense of community. You have to. You can't last. No one can last. They're an island unto themselves. It's impossible. That's why people, sometimes they get married. Why do they get married? Because they're lonely. Although they're amidst of all the devotees, they feel unhappy because they don't have a relationship with the other devotees. So they feel like, I need a wife or I need a husband in order to make up for that relationship, which may or may not be true. So whatever we do, we should always try to see how we can get some assistance and some enthusiasm, some advice in what we do. Like that. You know, I'll come up to you and I'll say, Shankar, today I'm going to chant 64 rounds. And I'm not going to do anything else. What do you think about that? You tell me you're in Maya. Why don't you do some service? So I'll know, okay. He's not agreeing to that idea, so maybe it's not a good idea. So we can approach devotees, or just if it's a little austerity, such as, you know, I'll refrain from eating no sweets. I'll give up eating sweets. So is it? What do you think? So that's a good idea. To refrain from eating sweets is because the more sweets you eat, the harder it is to control your mind and senses. And so that might be a good austerity. But for some people, it might be too much. And for others, it might be perfect. So there's where we get some advice. Or we can try it. If it seems to be working, you can undergo austerities by testing them, trying them for a little while, see if they work. Work means, how do you tell if something is working or not working? It means that you're becoming more enthusiastic in your devotional service. That's the only consideration. If what I'm doing is making me more enthusiasm to chant, to serve, to associate, to participate, then that austerity is good. If the austerity is pushing me the other way, and then we might say, well, it's needless. It's not right. That's the understanding. What is helping us to become more Krishna conscious or more enthusiastic in devotional service? That's why sometimes, you know, when people come into the temple, we don't engage them properly. We ask them to do all kinds of service. And it appears like, you know, they're doing so much service, but after a while they go away because they're not engaged properly. They're not engaged properly. So therefore we have leadership in our movement to understand how to engage others, engage themselves nicely in Krishna consciousness. Like that. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
One of the scriptures you mentioned was that we should commit violence towards any other living entity.
Mm-hmm.
And under all certain circumstances, like a pest control situation. You know one thing, but yet you can force it to another. Now, I know Prabhupada said if you don't feed the guests will go away. But at the same time, it's so difficult for us to keep areas so clean that panic and death go away. And I noticed in other temples, you can also have a kind of pest control. And if it's not dealt with sometimes, you know, seriously, then you really have. So I'm glad to see that we have dealt with the problem, but at the same time, you said we should be more for the innocent, not for the innocent, but they are living innocent, just unfortunately in another body. How do we reconcile this?
Well, you're right. And everything you say, and also your conclusion is very right, that it's a living entity in another body. So Prabhupada was asked that question, we have some roaches, what should we do? Should we kill them? Prabhupada said, no, you should be killed. That was his answer. He says, because you are dirty, they're coming. He says, because you are unclean, they are coming. So there are three types of activities. There's activities in the mode of goodness, activities in the mode of passion, and activities in the mode of ignorance. So what is cleanliness in the mode of passion? Cleanliness in the mode of passion means when things get dirty, you clean it. Mode of ignorance means you just don't clean it, or you don't clean it thoroughly. You keep it dirty at least. Mode of goodness means you never let it get it dirty. It stays clean constantly. Not that you wait till it gets dirty and you clean it. You keep it clean. And that's the mode of goodness. So Srila Prabhupada would say our temples should be revolutionary clean. That was the word he used. He didn't say clean, he said revolutionary clean. So clean that when people come in immediately they feel a sense of, they can feel the cleanliness. You know, you walk into a clean place or a neat place, sometimes when it's immaculate, immediately you feel, it just wakens your senses up to something. That's the way you want in our temples to be. So if you have roaches, get rid of them. But realize there's some offense there. Because you can't allow the deity kitchens to stay dirty. So reverse the situation, but get it clean and keep it clean. Don't let it go down again. And that means every day there's a thorough cleaning of the kitchen. Not just once a day, once a week or whatever. I know, I used to be a cook for years and I had the same problems. But therefore you have to have a standard that if there's nothing to eat, they won't come. You have to make it so clean. Like that. It's not easy to do, but you have to do it. And another thing is cleanliness means simplicity. If you're simple, you can be clean. If you're not simple, you can't be clean. If you have too much junk, if you store everything everywhere in every place of the temple, impossible to be clean. You have to be simple. You have to have what you need and a little bit over that. But beyond that, there's no question of cleanliness when you have And you have more than you need.
You store it like that.
Prabhupada said, if you haven't used it in 2 years, give it away. Go through everything you have. If you haven't used it in 2 years, then you don't need it. Right? You can understand heaven? So, sometimes we keep things from, you know, hoping someday we'll you need it. Just, you know, you recycle it, give it away. Or store it outside of the temple if it's really valuable. But don't clutter. Yeah. Okay. That's pretty much the principles. Yes?
You had mentioned about speech and violence. Just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about that.
The offensive speech?
Yeah.
Well, Janaka Pandit says that there's three things in this world that are considered the opulence of this world. He said, Rajakishore, he's Janaka Pandit expert, right? You remember this one? He said, three things that are considered the opulences of this world: food, water, and soft speech. Remember that one? Food and water are considered the opulences of this material world, and necessities, and soft speech includes that. So one should speak pleasantly, without criticism, without pretentiousness, without attachment, without anger. One should be pleasant. Of course, sometimes in the way of speaking and giving classes or preaching, we're a little bit strong and bold, and that we have to be. But in our ordinary dealings, and we should, you know, you don't come up to another devotee and start chastising him with slokas from the Bhagavatam. Dayato vishatam pumsam sangha teshu jadayate, you're in maya. You know, come up with all these. You know, we should be, keep pleasant, friendly relationships with devotees. We shouldn't be harsh. If you're harsh with another person, leaders think I can be harsh because I'm a leader. And I have to be, you know, tough guy, so now nobody will listen to me. But Prabhupada wasn't like that. Prabhupada did things by purity. So, you can command respect and not demand respect. That's, a devotee is like that. So in our dealings with others, we should be straightforward. We should be polite and respectful. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, we should give respects to everyone, no matter who they are, non-devotee or non-devotee. Respect in the sense that we honor the fact that that's a living entity inside that body, and in that body also the super soul exists. Just like the process of paying obeisances, what are we doing when we pay obeisances? We're honoring the Lord within the heart of that living entity. So God is there in everyone's heart. So when you pay your obeisances to another person, you're actually paying your obeisances to the Lord in the heart of that person. You're seeing. If you simply see the body, then you're just seeing, you're not seeing correctly. You're not seeing correctly. We interact by making distinctions based on bodily designations. But ultimately, we see every living being as spirit soul. Just like, you know, we don't intimately associate with the opposite sex because that is can fall down in Krishna consciousness. So that restriction is there. We make a distinction between association between men and women. Or you don't embrace a tiger, although a tiger is Krishna, parts and parcel of Krishna also. Krishna is in the heart of the tiger. Or if an envious person comes, you may avoid that person. Or so in the same way, although we make distinctions based on bodily designations, still ultimately we give respects to everyone because of the ultimately being a spirit soul and Krishna is in the heart. And respect may manifest in different ways. In other words, a devotee doesn't envy anyone. A devotee doesn't envy anyone. A devotee doesn't want anything from anyone. He wants to give. That's pretty much the answer to your question. And that in our relationships, we should want to give to others. If we try to get, and there's a tendency, we could also become offensive in that relationship. So the devotee is always thinking, how can I serve? We're thinking, how can I serve? Then whoever we come in contact with, it's an opportunity to serve that person. In one way or the other, that service may take on just friendliness, may take on giving instructions, may take on receiving instructions, may take on doing something for that person. It may even take on the fact that you're allowing that person to do something for you. These are all forms of service. But ultimately, the consciousness is service. In the consciousness of getting, then we don't really appreciate that person if we want somebody to give something to us. We don't appreciate that person. Because we're looking at that as a person as an opportunity to fulfill our desires, rather than to serve that person. So in our speech, we should try the best we can to have that mood of wanting to serve like that. Okay, is that sound complete enough? Anything else? Any other questions, comments? Okay, I'm running past. It's about breakfast time. As they say, one cannot live by philosophy alone. There are other forms of nourishment. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Glorious to share.